You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a quick heads up. Next Monday and Tuesday, I'll be in New York for a couple of TV shows. You'll find out about those on Monday. On Thursday of next week, I'll be in Chicago at the Frugal Muse Bookstore in Darien, Illinois, at 7 o'clock. More information on WCPT's website and at TomHartman.com. And Saturday, November 16th, at 6 p.m., I'll be at the Operating Engineers Hall. And this is a ticketed event, AM 950 Radio, our affiliate, AM 950, Minnesota's Progressive Voice, AM950Radio.com for the information on that. This is all because my new book, The Crash of 2016, is being released this week. So just a heads up on that. And speaking of the crash of 2016, one of the guys whose name you will see on the very back cover of it, giving a blurb to it, is Senator Bernie Sanders, who just by coincidence is here with us. Senator Sanders, it is great having you once again for the hour. And just to all of our listeners, if anybody is tuning in for the first time, after our initial little rant here, Bernie will be taking your calls. So if you want to talk with Senator Sanders, give us a shout.
And
what's up,
Tom,
buddy?
If I live to be 1,000, I will never know where you get the energy to do everything that you do.
It's a simple answer, Bernie. I'm a hyperactive kid who grew up.
Well, I don't know. It takes me 5 hours to write the 700-word op-ed, and you are knocking off books faster than I can write a column. So.
Well, this one took 2 years, actually. But thank you for your kind words. I appreciate it.
Well, there's a lot, obviously, that is going on in Washington. Let me begin. Okay, you know, every now and then some good news comes out of Washington. I wanted to talk about some what I consider to be very good news. In the Affordable Care Act, one of the provisions I fought very, very hard for, kind of led the effort on, was to see an $11 billion expansion in community health centers. In the midst of a dysfunctional healthcare system, which we currently experience, community health centers are a very bright spot. And what they do in 50 states in this country is provide high-quality primary health care, dental care, mental health counseling, and the lowest prescription drug costs in the entire country. And they are serving many, many, many millions of people. The Health and Human Services Department just announced yesterday the release of $150 million of that $11 billion we got them, which will establish 236 new community health centers throughout this country. Three of them are going to be in Vermont. Many of them are going to be in California. And that will provide access to health care, Tom, for 1.25 million Americans who will now be able to go into a doctor's office and get health care regardless of their income, get dental care and mental health counseling. So it's a good step forward, and it's something that we should be putting more and more resources into, making sure that everybody in America has access to good quality primary health care and dental care is enormously important. And in the long run, it saves us money because it keeps people out of emergency rooms. When you treat people, when they first become ill, they don't end up in the hospital, et cetera, et cetera. We lose about 45,000 people every single year who die because they don't go to a doctor when they should. And the expansion of community health centers is a very good remedy to that. So we're glad to see that is happening. I am a member of the Budget Conference Committee, and we continue to have discussions of how we end this sequestration, which is causing a whole lot of problems for folks who use Head Start, people who are on various nutrition programs, the Meals on Wheels program, the WIC program, and then it's just a very, very bad idea. So the challenge that we face is working with a very, very conservative House. How do we come up with a proposal that ends the sequestration and gives us a long-term budget? My own view is that at a time when the wealthiest people in this country are doing phenomenally well, when 95% of all new income being created goes to the top 1%, when one out of four corporations in America doesn't pay a nickel in taxes, and when the corporate tax burden as part of our GDP is much, much less than it used to be, I think it is absolutely appropriate that we ask the wealthiest people in this country and large corporations to help us not only with deficit reduction, but help us with revenue so that we can address the major economic crisis facing this country, and that is high unemployment. Real unemployment is not 7.3%, which is what's usually on the front pages of the paper. It's really 13.8% if you include those people who are working part-time when they want to work full-time and those people who have given up looking for work. So we have a major unemployment crisis in this country. It is even worse among young people. It's worse among African Americans and other minorities. And this is an issue that we have got to address. So as I have stated many times, my goal is to see us invest in our crumbling infrastructure, our roads and bridges and rail, water systems. Every state in the country needs that kind of help. We create a whole lot of jobs. We have to move this country to energy efficiency and sustainable energy to combat global warming. We do that. We create jobs. So there are ways that we can do that. And when you create jobs and grow the economy, you know what? Deficit goes down because more people are paying taxes. So that's the issue that we're going to be working on there. One area that I remain very, very concerned about, which gets very little discussion, I think, is the growing wealth and income inequality in America. And I don't know either from a moral perspective or certainly from an economic perspective how you have a dynamic economy when so few have so much and so many have so little. And one way to address that issue is something that some of us are working on, and I hope we'll get to the floor in a reasonably short period of time. And we need the help of the American people to get this passed. And that is raising the minimum wage to at least $10 an hour. Right now, nationally, the minimum wage is all of 7 1/4 an hour. A number of states throughout the country, including the state of Vermont, have minimum wages which are higher than that. But what we have got to address is the reality that many of the new jobs being created, sadly, are low-wage, part-time jobs. You've got to have at least a $10.10 minimum wage. Senator Harkin and I and others are pushing that. I think the American people understand that that is the right thing to do. But we've got to get some of, and I think we have virtually unanimous support within the Democratic caucus. It's probably 55 votes. But if we're going to overcome a Republican filibuster, we need 5 votes in the Senate, 5 Republican votes, and we're going to need some support in the House. So I would hope the American people rally upon the need to raise the minimum wage. Congress or Senate also this week passed the end of legislation, which would put an end to workplace discrimination against gay people. I think that that is part of the strong evolution that we have seen in this country in trying to end discrimination, whether it's against blacks, whether it's against women, and whether it's against gays. So it's an important piece of legislation, which passed with a pretty good vote on Thursday. Lastly, as chairman of the U.S. Senate Veterans Committee, I just want to thank all of the folks who are listening, who have served in our military. We're trying to do our best by veterans. We're trying to figure out ways that we can expand and improve health care for our veterans, also include dental care, deal with the issues of military sexual abuse. A lot of issues out there that we're working on, but I just want to take this opportunity on Veterans Day to thank all of our veterans.
Yeah. And Veterans Day is coming up next week, right?
It's Monday, yeah.
Yeah, Monday, yeah. It's also Louise and my, it'll be our 44th anniversary.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyhow, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders here taking your calls right after the break. It is 15 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. We will be back with more of Senator Sanders. Be sure to check out his website, sanders.senate.gov, and sign up for the Bernie Buzz. I get it. It's a great news source.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And also, just a heads up, my new book, The Crash of 2016, should be shipping to bookstores this week. And you can also ask for it at your local library. You can read it for free. And welcome back, Carol, in Camano Island, Washington, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite TV system. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, hello, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Carol.
Hi. I wanted to find out if you, and what your thoughts are on this subject, if you have heard about the new contract offer that Boeing has offered to their mechanics. They have really asked the mechanics to take huge cuts. They're changing their pension plans from a defined benefit to a lump sum that Boeing will contribute to each year based on their salary. They want the workers to take huge increases in the cost of their health insurance. Right now, health insurance costs their workers about $50 a month, and they want to raise it to about $300 to $400 a month. They just came out with this plan on Wednesday, and they have given the mechanics 1 week to think about it and vote on it. And they have told them that if they reject this new contract, which is an eight-year contract, they will produce the 777X in South Carolina, which means that there will be huge cuts in the workforce in Boeing here.
And that's a right to work for less state.
They also want the state to give Boeing millions of dollars in tax breaks in order to have Boeing produce this plane in Washington state. I wondered if you had heard about that and what you think about it.
Well, no, I hadn't heard about it, but you know, this is, it's an outrage. It's the continuation of the war by corporate America on working people. And it is, what you've just described, Carol, is why the middle class in this country is disappearing. It used to be that people who built things, whether they were working for Boeing and building airplanes or building automobiles or whatever, actually made a strong middle class wage. And that is disappearing. And the way what Carol has just described is exactly the reason for that. What companies are doing is exerting their power. They're going to war against workers. Often they're threatening that they will shut down in America and go to China or go someplace else. In this case, I guess, they're threatening to shut down in Washington and go to South Carolina unless they get their corporate welfare and they get their major benefit cuts. So thank you for alerting me to that, Carol. It is a sad story that we are seeing all over this country.
Bernie, I my dad worked in a tool and die shop for 40 years, and I remember when the contracts came up for renegotiation, we were all really excited because it meant dad was going to get a raise.
Right.
Then came Reagan. It's really changed since then, hasn't it?
Oh, it's radically changed. And I think a point that is not made often enough, every now and then you'll see an article in some paper that manufacturing jobs are coming back to America. And we're seeing an increase, an uptick in manufacturing jobs. If you look at the fine print, what you find is that many of these new jobs are paying a fraction of what they used to pay. In Detroit, for example, there's almost been a 50% decrease in the wages that new automobile workers are making compared to older workers. So this has a lot to do with unfettered free trade, the fact that American workers have been forced to compete against desperate people all over the world, the weakness of unions nowadays, and the greed of corporate America.
Yeah, 32 years of Reaganomics has really, really done a job on this. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Brunch with Bernie. More of your questions, Bernie's answers right after this. True People's Media, the Tom Hartman Program, and Senator Bernie Sanders with us for our Brunch with Bernie Hour, taking your calls. Wayne in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Wayne, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi.
Yes, I have a question for the Senator. Yes, Mr. Senator, do you know the exact current status of the TPP as far as fast track that is on going through Congress, and is there a way legally to stop it in its tracks?
The answer, Wayne, is there is certainly a way to legally stop it in its tracks. What fast track means, whether it's for the TPP or anything else, is an expedited process and it limits the ability of Congress to have amendments and to alter the bill. I have never been sympathetic to these disastrous trade agreements. This is a huge agreement dealing with Japan and Vietnam and a lot of the Far Eastern countries. It is being written by corporate America and by the drug companies. So I have serious reservations about it. It's also been done largely in secret. But we will do our best, at the very least, Wayne, to make sure that this thing is not fast-tracked.
Paul in San Francisco. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. I'm calling about the post office. And I understand that the reason it's having such financial difficulties is because of the prepayment of medical benefits out 75 years into the future.
Yep.
And I'm calling because those payments are they're payments to the Fed. Is that right?
And no, not to
so
the
basically
Fed.
That's a receivable enforceable by Congress?
No.
What
would be
the problem if they just ignored those payments?
No, Paul. What has happened is, you know, this is a result, I think, of 2006 legislation, which the Bush administration insisted upon. And as you've indicated, what that legislation required in an unprecedented way in America, no private company has to do this, no government agency has to do this, 75 years of prepayment for future future retiree health care benefits in a 10-year period, amounts to about $5.5 billion a year. That fund now has somewhere around $45 billion, I think. My view is that we should eliminate that payment. If you eliminate that payment from the Postal Service, being made by the Postal Service, the truth is the Postal Service today would be in reasonably good financial situation, close to breaking even. So we have legislation in that has a whole lot of support in the Senate that would do just that. We have concerns about another piece of legislation that's out there from the committee issued by Senators Carper and Coburn, which we think is a bad piece of legislation. So to answer your question, when we talk about the financial, so-called financial crisis of the Postal Service, that is by far, I think it's 80-85% of the problem right there. And if we address that, I think we will save the Postal Service, prevent massive reductions in force, and continue to provide good quality service for our people.
Richard in Winchester, Virginia. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, it's a pleasure and an honor to talk to you, Tom. Early happy anniversary.
Thank you.
What I want to talk about is, Senator Sanders, your minimum wage. I was listening to Rachel Maddow last night, and she mentioned that any time on a state level that minimum wage comes up, it passes like 60-70%. Senator Brown and one other senator got their start when they were elected over minimum wage. And I think that this is like a silver bullet if it comes up in the House. If it doesn't, get rid of Boehner. You know, just say, hey, You voted against minimum wage. How much did you increase your own salary? And follow through on that. And I think that if Democrats hammer at them with this, it's one thing that crosses all party lines. Republicans make $7.25 too.
That's right. Richard, I think you raise a very good point, and I think you're right, both from the public policy point of view. Look, I just do the arithmetic. If somebody is making $7.25 an hour, how do you survive? You just don't survive. You can't pay your rent, can't make your car payments, can't pay your electricity, can't have any health insurance. I mean, it's just the arithmetic is such that you just can't survive. If you have kids, it makes it even worse. But it's not just $7.25, which is the federal minimum wage. It's $8. It's $9 an hour. So if we can raise the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour, millions and millions of people who are now really living in very difficult straits will get at least a little bit of breathing room in terms of their income. And I think Richard also raises the politics of this thing. He's right. In New Jersey, but I think, I don't know if it was a high turnout or not, but 60% of the people there voted to raise the minimum wage. State after state, we have seen that. And poll after poll tells us that the vast majority of the American people, Republicans, Democrats, Independents, understand that $7.25 is a starvation wage, and we've got to raise it. The last point that I'd make on that, when you raise the minimum wage and you put more disposable income in people's pockets, that, in a sense, becomes an economic stimulant which creates more jobs. People have a little bit more money, are able to buy more goods and services. And furthermore, What we have got to end is a situation where companies like Walmart or Burger King or McDonald's are paying starvation wages, and then their employees making $7.25 or $8 or $9 an hour end up having to get Medicaid, end up having to get food stamps, end up having to get government-subsidized housing. So in a sense, the United States government and the taxpayers of this country are subsidizing these very large corporate interests. Does not make sense to me.
Clyde in Littleton, Colorado. I just got a one-minute cue. So quick question for Bernie. Oh, I'm hearing music. Oh, we just hit the break? Okay. Clyde, I'm going to put you on hold. I'm sorry. We got our time cues wrong here. We'll be right back with more of Senator Sanders. Actually, it worked out just right. Bernie just finished an answer. We'll be back with more of Senator Sanders answering your questions on the Tom Hartman program, on our Brunch with Bernie program right here.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And be sure to check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov, where you can sign up for the Bernie Buzz and find all kinds of great progressive and activist news. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, helping you win the water cooler wars. Senator Bernie Sanders with us in our Brunch with Bernie segment. And, Senator, you're with us still?
I am right here.
Okay. Clyde in Littleton, Colorado. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, Senator Sanders. It's a pleasure to talk with you. My question concerns both parties, either in the Senate or House, keep standing up and expounding the fact that they are speaking for the American people. And I'd like to know what you think about this and what you think we can do to address this.
Well, Clyde, in my view, we are in a rather unusual moment in American political history. I think the Republican Party very clearly, I think as most people perceive, has moved very, very far to the right. This is by no means, not in anyone's wildest stretch of imagination, is this the party of Dwight D. Eisenhower and many other moderate Republicans. This has become, over the years, a right-wing extremist party which believes essentially in ending Social Security, ending Medicare as we know it, massive cuts in Medicaid, privatizing the Veterans Administration in some cases. So this is a very far-right party. And I think in terms of their ideology of giving tax breaks to billionaires and cutting back on programs that working families need. To be very honest with you, Clyde, I don't think they represent 10, 15, most 20% of the American people. If people knew what they stood for, max 20%. Democrats do better, but I think also over, you know, the last many years, the Democrats have become a more conservative. They used to be, I think, generally thought to be the party of working families. I think probably most people no longer think that's the case. They're a centrist party. They're doing some very good things. But I think it would be a real stretch to say that in most instances they are prepared to stand up to big money and take on the powerful special interests that have so much influence in Washington. So I got to say that certainly the Republican Party is way out of touch with where the American people are. And I think you have millions and millions of people who are working longer hours for lower wages, who worry about whether their kids can afford college, who may have dropped into poverty, who are struggling with affordable health care. And they're looking around and they're saying, who represents me? Who represents my kids, my family? And I think there's a real political gap out there. So I would suggest, Clyde, that at this point, Republicans are way, way, way out of touch with the needs of ordinary Americans. And Democrats are going to have to do a lot better.
Marcia in Inglewood, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, it's Marcia.
Hi, Marcia.
Hi to both of you.
Hi.
Hi. I'm wondering if either one of you have seen Dan Rather's report on the education system in Finland.
Well, I have a little bit of knowledge of the education system in Finland. I don't know if I saw Dan Rather's piece.
I was just totally blown away. They don't have a parochial school system. All of the kids go to the same public school system. Every school is identical in their teaching methods. All of their teachers have to have, I believe it's master's degrees in education. and their education system costs them about a third less than what we're paying for our education systems throughout this country. And they have, like, almost no dropout rate.
Right.
They don't start their students until they're 7 years old, because at seven they feel that they're more ready to start learning than they are at four, five, or six. And their hour, they have shorter hours, but the kids learn more. And there isn't any testing. There's no scholastic testing. When those kids are ready to graduate, they're actually ready to graduate. And not all of them are trained in the same way, so that, you know, not all of them are geared towards college prep. Some don't want college prep. Some wouldn't qualify for college prep if they tried, so why bother?
Marshall, let's get Bernie's thoughts on this.
I think, Marshall, thanks for your observation. You know, as Tom and I have mentioned many, many times, there is so much to learn from other countries around the world. What Marshall is talking about is education in Finland, if my memory is correct, Tom. I think generally in these international exams, Finnish students come close or always at the very top.
They are almost always either number one or number two, Finland and Singapore, the two top countries.
So they have a very strong educational system. Okay. But I think that quality education and respect for education, and if my memory is correct, they attract the best and the brightest.
Their teachers are paid about the same as their doctors.
Oh, well, there you go. Okay. So in other words, this is a country that values education, respects teachers, respects intellectual activity, also has a social safety net, which is far, far stronger than what we have in the United States in terms of providing health care to all people, strong child care, strong parental rights when you have a baby and getting time off from work, strong retirement benefits. So I think in general, whether it is education or many other areas of social life, there is a lot to be learned from the Scandinavian model, which is a model which has strong egalitarian roots, where people work together, where you don't have the income and wealth disparities that we have in the United States, where kids go to school and understand that it is important to do well in school because they have an opportunity to make it into the middle class. In our country, one of the very sad aspects of how we handle kids is that a lot of kids at a very young age understand they are never going to make it into the middle class, and they tune out intellectually. We have 30% of our kids dropping out. So to answer Marsha's very good observation, there is a lot to be learned in many ways from what is going on in Scandinavia.
Joe in Chicago Heights, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello?
Hey, Joe. You're on the air with Bernie.
Hi. Thanks for all the good work you do. I just had a question, a theoretical question for Senator Sanders, and that would it be possible to pass a law that forbids corporations from making donations to any politician or not-for-profit organization if those corporations receive money from the federal government through businesses or tax deductions? And likewise, would it be possible to pass a law requiring companies to pay back the depreciation they deduct before they can sell their industry to an offshore company?
Well, Joe, you know, theoretically, it is possible to do anything. But I think in terms of what you're talking about, I think the way we get to the root, the easiest way and the simplest way to getting to the root of the absurdities of our current campaign finance situation, where as a result of Citizens United, corporations can spend an endless amount of money on the political process. I think the way to get the cleanest way to do that is simply to end this disastrous Supreme Court decision of Citizens United. And I think also we need to move to public funding of elections. That is what we really have got to do. I think that's the cleanest approach which will pass constitutional muster. So the issue that you're touching on of campaign finance may well be the most important issue facing our country, because unless we get a handle on that, unless we prevent corporations and big money interests from buying elections and buying politicians, all of the other issues, whether it's healthcare or jobs or the environment or global warming or education, those are not going to be able to be dealt with in a significant way if big money is able to buy the Congress. So thanks for the question.
Mark in Chico, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. How are you today?
Good.
Hey, you know, I was thinking, all these people that don't have voter IDs, I'm wondering if a nonprofit or a 501c4 or something like that could get a start making donations and helping these people get birth certificates or IDs or whatever. And also, I have one comment. It seems like the our democracy, it seems like, has been bought off, and I'm really getting I'm so tired of it.
Okay, we just have a minute left here, Mark, so let Bernie get in here and answer.
A very valid point, and one that a whole lot of people throughout this country share. And that gets back to the previous question from Joe, and that is, if big money is able to buy elections and buy candidates, you know, we have to ask ourselves what kind of democracy we are living in, whether we're living in a dollarocracy or a democracy. In terms of the voter ID stuff, Mark, I think what we really have got to do is take these states to court. Their goal is very apparent. They don't want poor people voting in elections. They don't want old people voting in elections. They want to exclude as many people from the electoral process as possible who will vote against them. And that is so undemocratic, so outrageous, and so illegal and unconstitutional that we have just got to be very aggressive in taking them on.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman program. Check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. Back with more calls for Bernie right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And my new book, The Crash of 2016, is shipping this week. You can check it out in your local library. Welcome back. Donna in Dallas, Texas, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Hartman, and thank you for this platform that you have offered us to speak to wonderful Senator Sanders. My question is regarding something called the windfall elimination provision. I am a retired public school educator in Texas, but I have also worked in what we in education call the real world, and therefore I accrued Social Security working in the real world. But as a retired public school educator, receiving my pension from the Texas Teacher Retirement System, I don't get all of those Social Security benefits because of the windfall elimination provision. And in my own case, there are $500 a month I don't get because of that. And $500 a month for me as a retired public school educator is a lot of groceries. So I'm wondering how we can motivate people in Congress to fix this. As I understand it, two things in particular. There are only 12 states, and which states they are, I am not sure, that have this issue. That's number one. And number two, as I also understand it, the whole windfall elimination provision was established in 1983, and I don't remember under what circumstances that happened. But if we can please fix it, because there are over 1 million of us who are affected by it.
Donna, this is an issue that has come up, and it comes up periodically, and I think it's a very legitimate issue. So it's something that we will take a look at and see what, I don't want to make any promises here, but see what we can go forward on.
Cherie, if I'm saying that right, in Moncton, Maryland, watching Free Speech TV?
Yes.
You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator. First of all, thank you. You are a truly the same person in our capital. My question is that why can't rather we fight for minimum wage? I'm 70 years old. I remember minimum wage being $4.35. Of course, in return, gas was 67 cents a gallon. Why can't we fight with corporate America to include the employees as a part of profit sharing? In other words, they put the capital and we put the manpower. Why do they get 99.9% and we end up getting nothing and being literally slave for life for these corporations? Is it possible?
Just have a few seconds here, Sherry, for Gordon to answer.
Well, bottom line is, Sherry, thanks for the question, and it's worth a lot more discussion than we have time today. I happen to believe that one of the economic models we have got to look at in this country is not just profit sharing, but worker ownership of companies, ESOP models, and that's something that we are working on. The truth of the matter is, as we heard at the very beginning of this program today from Carol, who was talking about what's going on with Boeing in Washington, workers are being ripped off day after day after day, and we've got to figure out a way and a mechanism.
We'll pick that up in just a second. Welcome back, Tom Harbin here with you. It's our Bunchy Bernie Hour. Senator Sanders, Sherry was just asking about why is it that, you know, the owners of the companies get everything and the workers who actually make the companies profitable very often get screwed.
And again, as I mentioned, we heard from Carol in the state of Washington earlier today about what's going on in Boeing workers, which is repeated every day all across this country. The corporations do very well in there. Squeezing and pushing workers, forcing them to pay more for health care or get lower wages or whatever. I think what Cherie is raising is just, you know, we are doing some work on that. There are in Vermont and Ohio, some other states, some efforts toward move to a worker ownership of companies. We have companies in Vermont that are literally owned by their workers. They make the decisions. They share the profits. Others have strong ESOP programs where workers do benefit and get increased wages and benefits as the company does better and better, and they're involved in that process. But I think that whole direction of giving workers more say about how companies are run, enabling people to get the benefits when companies do well, I think that it's not only the right thing to do for the workers, it's the right thing to do for the economy. I think people will feel better about their work, they'll be more productive, less absenteeism. And I think that's a goal that we should certainly shoot for. We have introduced a couple of pieces of legislation that would move us in that direction.
Cora in Taos, New Mexico, listening on KVOT. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator. Since we have a separation of church and state, why can't we have a separation of corporation and state?
that's a big question. I mean, the bottom line here is in America, what I will tell you is what you already know, is that corporations have enormous influence over what goes on a daily basis. And what has exacerbated that influence is this terrible Citizens United Supreme Court decision, which they said that corporations, right out of their own treasuries, can contribute into the political process. So rather than seeing a separation, we're seeing a marriage of corporations in the political process to the detriment of American democracy. I think, Cora, the answer, as I mentioned earlier, and just an issue of huge consequence, is not only the need to overturn Citizens United, and some of us have constitutional amendments in to do that, but it really is the drive toward public funding of elections so that big money interest cannot be allowed to buy candidates. And that is just an issue that we've got to continue to work on.
Jimmy in Arkadelphia, Arkansas. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, thanks, Tom. Good to talk to you all today. What I wanted to speak about was I do speak about Medicaid a lot, and I just wanted to ask Senator Sanders, why is Medicaid so hated, so ridiculed, and so stigmatized? I've had it for so long. I don't like to tell people I'm on Medicaid. Yeah. I like to tell them I have Medicaid. I receive it. And I'd just like for you to comment on that.
Well, Jimmy, good question. Thanks for asking it. I mean, it is part of the overall war that we're seeing on the part of big money interests and Republicans against the poor people. And it is, they're attacking food stamps. Anyone, you know, we have 85%, I think, or 80% of the people on food stamps today are elderly people. They're working families or lower-income families with kids. They're people with disabilities. And yet Republicans want to cut food stamps by $40 billion over the next 10 years. Medicaid is the same thing. They want to make devastating cuts. And that fits their narrative. You see, their political narrative is that the rich get richer, and millionaires, billionaires growing all the time because they're just wonderful, wonderful, bright, hardworking people. But for ordinary people who slip into poverty or are unemployed and who are low income, why, those are just terrible, terrible people ripping off the system. And Medicaid is just another example. Food stamps are another example. Nutrition programs, another example. And that feeds feeds to a certain political base out there that accepts that logic. So instead of having the courage to take on the big money interest, they're always beating up on poor people and lower income people, other people on Medicaid. So I think that's kind of why you see these attacks on Medicaid. And by the way, part of the Affordable Care Act, as you know, was to provide an expansion of Medicaid in every state in the country. It would be paid 100% by the federal government for the first 3 years and 90%. And the idea that states around this country, Republican states, are saying we are prepared to allow low-income people not to have any health insurance, not to have any Medicaid, even though it's going to cost the states nothing. We are prepared to allow that to happen and endanger the health and well-being of millions of people is, to me, to my mind, you know, just beyond comprehension.
Bernie, we have about a minute and a half before the end of the hour. Thoughts on the week and on the future, Congress, whatever's on your mind?
Well, there's a lot on the table, and I think we have discussed some terribly important issues today. The issue of campaign finance reform, the fact that the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson and these other guys can spend huge sums of money, not just Republicans, you have Democrats, some Democrats doing it as well, is not what American democracy is about. Got to keep our eyes on the prize. And Citizens United, move to public funding of elections. This attack against working families, we've heard that from Carol, what's going on in the Boeing contract, attack against unions, the attack against poor people. We heard it at the beginning of the show, we heard it at the end of the show. Jimmy is talking about the attacks on people who are in Medicaid, who have misfortune to be poor, but who are entitled, like every other human being, to health care. They're being attacked every day. Republicans want to devastate, make massive cuts to Medicaid. Carol talks about what's happening to union workers in Washington by Boeing, attacks on those folks. So across the board, what you're seeing is an unprecedented level of attack by the big money interest in Wall Street against working families, against lower-income people. They want more tax breaks for the billionaires, and they want to cut back on Medicaid and Social Security and Medicare. I think their priorities are absolutely not where the American people are. They're wrong from a moral and economic point of view, and we've just got to continue our efforts to fight back.
Thank you so much for all you do toward that, Bernie. Thank you, Senator Sanders. Thank you so much, Bernie, for being here. Great talking to you. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. Solar World has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. Just a quick reminder, we start book tour next week. And Thursday, I'll be in Chicago at the Frugal Muse. And Saturday, I'll be in Minneapolis at the Operating Engineers Hall. The week after that, the week after next, we'll be in Denver Tuesday, Los Angeles Wednesday, San Francisco Thursday, Portland Friday, and then Washington, D.C. the week after that, the third week of November. So all that information is available over at TomHartmann.com, and in fact, we'll have even more details probably 40 minutes from now when I finish. I've got to update my own site, because Shane created a really neat little website that shows, the, you know, for the book and the book tour and everything, and we'll get that out to you. So anyway, just a heads up with that. It's Friday. It's Anything Goes Friday. Today's the day if you want to talk about, you know, is it really possible that John Boehner zips on his human suit every morning? Or any other topic you want to... No, seriously, David Icke's, you know, the British guy who draws huge audiences. He's been for years saying that Bill Clinton zipped on his lizard suit. I think he recently came out and said that Barack Obama is actually a human. So I thought that was fascinating. David Icke's made news last week or the week before. I remember noticing that. So anyway, we could also talk about more serious things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Tracy in Buffalo Grove, Illinois, you wanted to talk about the TPP?
Hi.
Hi.
Yes, I've just been hearing more about it lately, and I know you had another caller earlier, and I just, this is important because of the secrecy with which surrounds this, and you know, the little bit that I'm hearing, apparently, people in Congress to talk about it because the concern that some information as to what's being talked about will come out. But
no, actually, you know, let me correct that misperception, Tracy.
Oh, good.
Bernie has said on this air, Peter DeFazio has said on this air, Senator Sherrod Brown has said on this air, and Alan Grayson has said on our program, all of them at various times in the last two or three weeks, that they are not allowed to see the details of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that Congress is not privy to this. And they're quite upset about it. So
okay, so then the people who are part of the committees or
it's not being negotiated by congressional committees. It's being negotiated by a group that has been convened by the countries involved, and the people who are on that committee representing the United States are apparently appointed by the executive branch, by the president, and apparently none of them are elected officials. They are all corporate officers.
And so, again, you know, with the little bit of information that unfortunately...
Along with perhaps people from the Trade Department or something. Yeah.
But it seems that that there may be laws that we have on our books that if other countries that are part of this agreement, you know, if we do this, that they could sue because of these laws. I mean...
Yes, that's how it works with NAFTA right now. Yes.
So... Please correct me or school me. You know, how to, it seems like that affects our sovereignty.
Yes.
Number one. I mean, well, number one, I think number one is really, this is going to really screw us in terms of jobs and so forth. But
every trade deal so far has.
Yes. So why are we pursuing this? Why are are there just that many corporate Democrats that are going along with us? I just don't understand.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, all the voices who have spoken out against it, to the best of my knowledge, have been Democrats, although there may be some Tea Party Republicans who are opposed to it. But the fact of the matter is that the Trans-Pacific Partnership, just like every other so-called free trade deal, is something that benefits big transnational corporations and billionaires and doesn't benefit or even actively hurts working people in the United States and the other countries that are involved in most cases. And the tragic reality is in many of these other countries, because their politicians aren't completely owned, although in most cases they are, they actually still have some semblance of rational trade policy. You know, China still protects their domestic industries, for example. But here in the United States, not so much, because the Supreme Court has said that it's legal for corporations and billionaires, even foreign corporations, to own our politicians. And so far, this is just coming out of the executive branch. It's President Obama and the Department of Commerce, people within the Department of Commerce, and these various corporations and their lawyers and their lobbyists who are, you know, meeting with the people from Vietnam and Japan and all the other countries involved. I don't know the whole list of them. But you know, ultimately, like with other trade deals, like with the Colombia trade deal, we've seen several of these now. They will be dropped in the lap of Congress, and they're going to try and fast track it and say, you know, quick, pass it, no amendments, no debate, nothing, yes or no, up or down vote, majority only, can't be filibustered. That's all the bad news. The good news is people are waking up to this thing. And I think that there's a groundswell growing. And I think it's happening not just among Democrats and not just on progressive programs like this. But I think that actually I have no idea if it's being discussed on conservative talk radio because I don't listen to it, or on Fox News because I don't watch it. But, you know, maybe some of our listeners or folks who are aware of that could let us know. But I doubt it'll even be covered on the progressive corporate media too much. I haven't seen any coverage of it whatsoever on progressive corporate television. But you know, Amy Goodman's been all over this with Democracy Now. We talk about it regularly. Other progressive shows talk about it regularly. And I think when they bring this thing forward, they're going to be awfully surprised by the amount of blowback that they're going to get, because people are just over it with these free trade deals. And in fact, the opposite, I think, is the case. Sherrod Brown pointed this out the last time he was on this program. If the Democratic Party would take the position that we're going to do away with all these trade deals, we're going to go, you know, roll us back to before, you know, back when Ross Perot was talking about the dangers of this stuff, take us back to pre-96, that there's, you know, or pre-92, that, and actually, I mean, you know, Reagan in a large part started this with the most favored nation status and all this kind of stuff, that if the Democratic Party took that position, they'd never again lose an election. So that's what I know about it, Tracy. And everybody's waiting for the other shoe to drop, which is going to be when the administration says, okay, Congress, here's the deal. And if I had to bet, I'd say it's going to be Christmas Eve or New Year's Eve, but we'll see. Tracy, thank you for the call, and thanks for raising the topic. Robert in Downey, California. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Yes, hi, Tom. I got a scenario for you that you might want to discuss. It might relate to your book. And that is, you remember LBJ and Guns and Butter?
Yeah.
And now we got guns and billionaires.
Well, what LBJ did that led to that hyperinflation was what George W. Bush tried to do, which is he did not put the Vietnam War on the budget. And so, you know, basically they tried to inflate their way, you know, deflate the currency, depreciate the currency with inflation so that we could pay off the cost of the Vietnam War with less valuable dollars. When the good news is that when Obama came into office 5.5 years ago, the first thing he did was he took all these things that George Bush had not put on the budget, which was the tax cuts for billionaires, both wars, Afghanistan and Iraq, and Medicare Part D. And in aggregate, this is several $1 trillion, which would have been an inflation bubble, you know, just coming down the road, 5-10 years down the road. Barack Obama put that on the budget. And that's why, in large part, why our debt, quote, exploded, end quote. It didn't actually explode. You know, it had accumulated throughout those Bush years, but Obama put it on the budget, so it's right there for everybody to see, and it's going to have to be paid off rather than inflated out. So I don't think that we've got a huge inflation bubble in our future, although God only knows. I could be wrong, Robert. Thank you for the call. Sometime in the next, I don't know, few weeks, I want to get one of these folks who's, you know, like Robert Wolf or Richard Wolf, who's a really good economist who knows this stuff better than I do, to talk about that. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
But in the meantime, if you're curious about this, check out Modern Money Theory or Modern Monetary Theory and watch one of the Stephanie Kelton videos. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Bruce, listening on KBCS in Auburn, Washington, our Pacific affiliate there in the Seattle area. Hey, Bruce, what's up?
Well, Tom, I was watching something on TV the other day, and I thought about you because you hit the nail on the head. It was something on the History Channel called The Man Who Built America. It was about Morgan, Getty, Rockefeller, and Carnegie. And this is just nothing but a rerun. All they did was they bought McKinley, basically, and they were screwed when he ended up getting assassinated and Roosevelt became the president.
Right.
And
Teddy.
The way that they talked among themselves about the average person was just horrendous. And they were talking about convincing the average people that they were good for them because they provided them jobs, even though it was a meager living. And they couldn't stand Henry Ford, who wanted to give a guy an average wage so he could buy the car. And so this is nothing but a rerun we're looking at right
yeah.
now, Tom.
Did they have the story in there, Bruce, about when Rockefeller's PR advisor told him to go out on the street and hand out brand-new shiny dimes to people?
I'm not sure. I don't think, you know, it was a four-part deal, and I caught like three and a half parts of it, so I may have missed that part.
That was one of the amazing parts of it. There was a period of time there at the late part of the 19th or early part of the 20th century when these billionaires could actually walk around in public, when they weren't hated and reviled. The hated and reviled part came in the 19-aughts, you know, and into the 19-teens. And John D. Rockefeller's PR advisor told him to take a roll of dimes. And of course, a dime back then would buy what, you know, easily a dollar, maybe $5 would buy today. And take a brand new roll of shiny dimes down on the street in front of his office and pass them out to the ragamuffins, you know, to the kids who were the shoeshine boys and the newspaper boys and the people who were homeless and the people who were looking for work, and have a photographer take the picture and get it in the newspapers. And he did. And it was, for a couple of weeks, it was portrayed as John Rockefeller, the great philanthropist, you know. It's like,
oh, wow. It's amazing because McKinley, they pretty much bought and paid for him.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he was pretty much bought and paid for. And I'm pretty sure there's probably been some presidents since then. And I just don't understand how people, even though they may disagree with, you know, a left-leaning philosophy, can come up and defend these type of people. I mean, we need to get rid of all these corporatists as far as their influences in government and have a real debate, a real dialogue between people from the left and the right who want to get to the same goal by doing things, you know, and getting there differently.
Yeah.
I just don't understand what the deal is here. I really don't.
Well, see, back then it was relatively legal in the United States for corporations and rich people to own politicians, and they did. They did aggressively. In fact, you could say a lot of it started in the Lincoln administration with all the money to be made off the Civil War. But there's a hotel here in town that I've been at. I think it's the Willard, which is right across the street from the White House, or a block away. And the lobby of that hotel, as I recall, and it might be the restaurant next door to it. I've been in both places, but the local folklore, and I think it's probably true, and I think it was during the Lincoln administration, although it might have been the McKinley administration, but that was the lobby where the politicians would go and get drinks, and there's a bar there. Politicians would go and get drinks, and the businessmen would go and give money, and that's where the word lobbyist came from, was it had to do with the lobby of either that hotel or the restaurant next door to it. It's amazing. And this, you know, and for a while we made it illegal, right? Especially after the Nixon administration. But now our Supreme Court has made it legal again. And that's what we've got to do is we've got to change that. MoveToAmend.org. Bruce, thanks for the call. And we're available in libraries too, where you can read it for free. Hey, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Charles, Miami, Florida. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me okay?
Just fine, yeah. Is my voice a little faint on your end? People ask me that a lot.
A wee bit, but I can hear you.
Okay.
I'm just calling to make a suggestion. On one of your shows, I think it was The Conversation with the Great Minds, and it was over a year ago, you were conversing with someone, and the comment came up that what is the purpose of an economy? Hmm. And I thought it was such a great question that, like, we all should answer. And, you know, our the presidential candidates at the time, it would have been nice if they answered it. And I want to suggest to you that perhaps you could ask people, especially your guests when you get them on, what do they envision an economy? What's the purpose of an economy? And what do they envision a society would look like as a consequence of their vision?
Yeah.
How would the society function as a result of the economic perspectives that they have, or even the policy objectives that they have? And I think, you know, it could, I think so few of us really understand economics really well. And I just finished a course by Thomas Sowell, who's a pretty right winger. But it was very good because it opened my eyes up about supply and demand and how society really functions and how society can function. And I was hoping that maybe you could get some dialogues with people and put them up against the wall, both left and right.
Mm-hmm.
What would happen as a consequence of your objectives, of the things that you're advocating for?
Right. Well, you know, probably the first really famous economist to address that question when economics was just first emerging as a science was Adam Smith. And it wasn't his book, The Wealth of Nations, which everybody always quotes, that asked that question, why do you have an economy? But it was his book, A Theory of Moral Sentiments, and which is the less famous and, frankly, far more important book that Adam Smith wrote. And it was published in the 1770s. And in A Theory of Moral Sentiments, Adam Smith comes right out and asks that question, you know, what is the purpose of an economy? And then answers it essentially saying the reason, now I'm wildly paraphrasing, I'm taking, you know, like in chapters of the book and turning them into sentences here, but in essence what he says, and then David Ricardo expanded this somewhat in 1817 in his On Labor and On Profits and some of his writings. But basically what they were saying was that we create an economy. We create a government to provide for the common good, the general welfare, you know, those phrases that are in the preamble to the Constitution. The government then creates an economy by providing a currency that allows the economy to work and by providing basic rules within which an economy has to work. And the reason why the government creates the economy is the same reason why we created the government in the first place, and that is for the benefit of the people, of the populace. And so if we were to ask that simple question, and Charles, you really nailed it, of every piece of legislation that has economic impact, which is almost every piece of legislation, what impact will this legislation have on average working people via its impact on the economy? If we were to start asking that question, we would start passing some very, very, very different kinds of legislation than we have right now. But instead, I think that there's a broad belief among Americans, because they don't have any training in economics, that the purpose of an economy is so that people can get rich. And that's not the purpose of an economy. The purpose of an economy is so that the largest number of people through their own efforts, you know, with appropriate incentives, can produce the highest quality of life, both for themselves and for society as a whole. And is anything that I just said inconsistent with what you learned when you studied economics?
No, it isn't. And I would take it even further, because I think we need to have the in-depth conversations. An economy, a society is going to result as a consequence of an economy. And, you know, you're going to have houses and cities. And
sure.
And the level of
well, there's a certain chicken and egg.
Well,
you could also say an economy will come about as a result of a society, but yes.
Okay, and I actually would vote for an economy, you know, creates a society. But yes, you would have to have an awful lot of government control for a society to create an economy. But for an economy to create a society.
Well, no, you don't. Well, you've got 12 of us in a family or a tribe, and we have to decide, you know, we have different skills. We have to decide how we're going to trade goods and how we're going to trade skills. And you go back and you look at, like, the city of Corral from 6,000 years ago. There was one tribe that was rich with sardines, and there was another tribe that grew cotton and was making nets. The sardine people needed the nets. The net-making people needed the sardines. I've been in those, at the pyramids that they built down there. I wrote about it in my book, Threshold, and seen 6,000-year-old currency, which was just knots on a string. It was just a way, an accounting form. So the societies created an economy.
Okay, and that's, you know, again, chicken and the egg. But the big thing would be to get people to think about and talk about the consequences of our activities and how they impact all of us. And I think we as a people, Americans, are woefully uneducated when it comes to economics. And I think that would be a great, if people started, would actually realize what the impact of some of these policies are on the economy and how it hits them personally.
Right.
Then they might step back and say, you know, whoa, I need to be involved here. I need to be involved in this government. I need to be involved in this society politically, because everything they're doing is impacting people. And certain people are taking advantage of this and making a lot more wealth than is just fair.
And this is something Republicans understand. They understand that at the end of the day, it's all about the money. Back to you, Charles.
My reason for calling you is to make that statement. How can we start to educate people? And you're one of the few, you know, avenues to do it.
Well, Charles, you've provoked me, thank you, to want to raise this question more frequently, and I will start doing so. Thank you for the reminder. It's been a while since we did a good show on that issue. And I do need, in particular with my right-wing guests, to start bringing it up.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Charles asked one of the best questions of the day. It's a question we need to constantly be asking. Why do we have an economy? Why do we sustain and support? Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you. And I think I just, did I update it? Shane, did it work? I don't know. Okay. I'll try it myself. If I click on, yeah, okay, cool, it works. If you go to TomHartman.com and click on the headline that says Tom's Book Tour, it will give you all the details of my book tour. And now I have to get back into the chat room, which we need to put on the menu on our homepage, because somehow I bombed out of the chat room in order to edit the homepage. But anyhow. It is Friday, as anything goes Friday. We'll be taking your calls on whatever topic you think is of consequence. And John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, well, first of all, as far as the economy, you know, I think people need to know that democracy is a very lofty idea, and this country is not a huge machine that creates millionaires and billionaires. It is to create a great civilization. I mean, isn't that what the founding fathers of this country and the Enlightenment, wasn't that what it was all about? I mean, you know, we're kind of chaining ourselves back to, I guess, a Rome or something like that. You know,
well, here, really let me just put it in context for you.
Unchain the economy and democracy, and we need to make, you know, democracy means that people are empowered. They're not empowered if they're poor peons, you know, getting screwed in you know, all in every way. And I wanted to, you know, the thing about the Trans-Pacific Partnership that never gets out there, besides eliminating manufacturing jobs and creating a lot of misery here, is that it's incredibly undemocratic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that story, you know, has been made by maybe people like you, Amy Goodman, The Progressive, The Nation, Harper's. You know, people need to read these magazines if they want to find out. You know, these people do journalism, the Rolling Stone. I mean, you know, we should, I think on your show, you should, you know, maybe it's insulting, I don't know, but, you know, don't watch, you know, except in small quantities, CNN and MSNBC, because they are, as Noam Chomsky says, part of the corporate structure, and they are only going to support, whether it's Democrat, Republican, corporate ideas which don't include us. I mean, not ordinary people.
I would slightly rephrase what you're saying, John, and I would say when you consume media, which it's impossible to avoid, I think, pretty much in this society. Louise and I didn't own a TV for all the years that our kids were young, from basically 1978 until, I don't know, 2002, I think, is when we first bought a TV, because I started doing this radio show and I needed to be able to see what was going on. But we were still consuming media, and you know, we were still, and a corporate media at that, we were still getting the same message. So I think the important point, and one that's probably totally consonant with what you're saying, is when you consume media, be aware of its internal bias, its secondary and in some cases primary goals, which is not to inform, but is to make a buck, and to protect its own interest, to protect its own turf, and to do so in a way that is, you know, a benefit to itself. And you know, we all need to become, and John, thank you for the call, we all need to become educated consumers of media. But that said, it's you can watch Fox News if you really want to see it on display. I mean, it's just with your mouth open, you know, wow, did he really say that? But here's the thing. When they put this country together, when the founders put this country together, which was arguably the first really serious effort at an Enlightenment-style modern democracy since the Greeks 3,000 years prior, arguably the Roman Empire in its early days before it was empire, before they left Italy, but mostly the Greeks, when they put it together, they made a statement of purpose. And as I read this to you, this is the preamble to the Constitution. It's one sentence. As I read this to you, listen carefully for the part where it says that we are creating this country so that people can become mind-bogglingly rich. To create a billionaire class. Listen for that. Because I don't think you'll hear it. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, capitalized justice, ensure domestic tranquility, capitalized tranquility, provide for the common defense, not capitalized. Back then, they capitalized things that were important. Promote the general welfare is capitalized. And secure the capital blessings of capital liberty to ourselves and our capital posterity. Do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Now, I would submit to you that what you have there are basically six statements of purpose. Union, justice, tranquility, welfare, liberty, and future generations, posterity. And nowhere in there, and that's the entire preamble to the Constitution, that's the entire statement of purpose, and nowhere else in the Constitution, including all the amendments right up to the most recent amendments just, you know, a decade or so ago, nowhere in there do you find any place where it says that the purpose of this country is to be able to produce multi-generational, multi-billion-dollar wealth. Which is not to say that that's inconsistent with the purpose of this country, although I would argue that it is, and that in the minds of the founders it was. But it is to say that it's not the primary purpose. And you get, but that's not what you will hear if you listen to right-wing talk radio or Fox News. What you will hear in those kind of venues is, oh, the founders created this country, very simple reason. They did it so that people could get rich. The American dream is to become Bill Gates. I don't think so. I think the American dream was to be my dad. To have a job that you could work at 40 hours a week and be able to support your entire family. My dad raised four boys and supported my mom. To be able to raise a family, to take a couple of 2-3 week vacation every single year, to have his house paid off by the time he died, plus 20,000 books in his basement and a fairly substantial collection of antiques that we spent years visiting every Salvation Army within 100 miles of Lansing collecting. And, you know, get a new car every 3 years and put your kids through school. and retire with a pension. That's the American dream. So anyhow, we got a full board of calls here. Let's get to it. Jim in Norwood, New Jersey. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd like to pick up on something that was suggested earlier by the senator. Somebody asked him a question, and the senator had brought up he would like to see more worker-owned companies and worker-owned businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, you also brought up Richard Wolff and Adam Smith. And I had an idea that I would like to suggest to you. I did a little research, and my understanding is that if 300 equity holders apply for a credit union charter, you get a charter for a credit union, then you need 3,000 active members.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what I was looking, what I was thinking was, you've got Adam Smith and Karl Marx, you know, they had, you know, capitalism and socialism. We've had a lot of time to experience the two and see all of their failures. And they were primarily first, they were philosophers. I would like to see if we could combine what we learned from both and take examples such as Stephen Gaskin, the farm in Tennessee,
mm-hmm.
and Richard Wolff's suggestion of Mondragon in
I've been to both places.
Basically make our own bank. That's the idea.
Yeah.
To make our own bank to fund an intentional organization with the express intention of funding progressive communities. And then there could be ancillary satellites all under the umbrella of a credit union. Mm-hmm. Much of what I think you made reference to earlier, you were talking about similar things. And I just wonder if this is an idea that could fly, you know? It needs somebody that's more educated than me, beginning with a lawyer, you know, to make application for a credit union.
Yeah.
But, you know, if 300 progressive equity holders put their money together and said, okay, let's start a bank.
Yeah.
And then you take 3,000 people, like, wouldn't be hard to find. I mean, you just find, like...
Well, there are credit unions all over the country, and many of them actually give money to their local community in ways, you know, they're engaged in local philanthropy that's fairly progressive. But I would like to see every state create a bank, like North Dakota has, and have those banks compete with the big national banks. I think that, you know, we could really give them a run for their money, and it would be a good and healthy thing for America. And there you've got we the people. I mean, that's small d democracy, although we've got to do something about the Supreme Court decision. Jim, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman over at free-don.org. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dave in Armstrong Creek, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call, and
sure.
Happy anniversary coming up for you and your wife.
Yeah, thanks. I probably shouldn't have said anything. Anyway.
Anyway, I was looking into some comparisons of some various healthcare systems around the world, and I found that Switzerland's was similar to the ACA that it was mandatory and run privately, and also there were government subsidies subject to income levels. However, there were some major differences. The insurance companies were not allowed to make a profit on the basic comprehensive plan, and which was available to everyone. And there were cost controls by the government, although they could sell some high-end services like dental and other things that they could make a profit on. And the cost per person was much less than in the U.S., and everybody'd be insured, and the outcomes were also better.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure this wouldn't be real popular with the insurance lobby or the Republican Congress, but
that's the problem.
I'd just like maybe get your thoughts on this.
No, I have, you know, we've debated healthcare on this program for a decade, and And I've often pointed out that, you know, people go, oh, you know, those Europeans are all socialists. They all have a single payer. And I say, no, Switzerland has no national health insurance program whatsoever. They have a law that says you have to have health insurance. And they have a law that says if anybody tries to offer health insurance on a for-profit basis or make a buck on health insurance, they go to prison. And that's it. And so, you know, there's this network of nonprofit insurers, not-for-profit companies in Switzerland that provide health insurance that, you know, they're basically like credit unions. They're not, you know, health insurance. People have to understand health insurance companies are basically banks. That's all they are. They're banksters. And not-for-profit banks like credit unions can actually be forces for good in a community. And not-for-profit health insurance companies in Switzerland actually work. It's, to the best of my knowledge, the only country in Europe anyway, maybe the only country in the world that operates like that. Do you know if I'm right on that, Dave?
As far as I know, I didn't see anything else that was privately run. No.
Yeah, I mean, there may be some health insurance companies in Switzerland that operate on a for-profit basis, but they don't offer primary health insurance.
Well, I think what it was they can make a profit on certain services.
Right.
But not on the basic comprehensive plan that
everybody
can get.
That's right. So if a very wealthy person wants to have an insurance policy that will get them a private jet if they get injured outside the country, or will...
Yeah, right. And some other things that certain people can afford different things.
Right.
But the basic plan is for everyone.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And you can make a buck on those top end plans. And that, you know, England changed their laws to allow for that maybe 15 years ago, as I recall. And it was a big deal. You know, it was very, very, you know, bitterly contested. But I think, you know, net, it's worked out OK. And frankly, you know, you're never going to stop rich people from taking the perks of being rich. So, you know, let them have their perks. But let's make sure that everybody else is covered. And this is the thing that's so insane about the Republicans in the United States is, you know, yeah, sure, you know, the Koch brothers can have all the, you know, they can own their own hospital if they want, but shouldn't we at least offer coverage to everybody in the country, to anybody, you know, everybody? Dave, thanks for the call. Thanks. We'll be back. Minutes before the hour, let's check in with Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, and find out what's going on in the world. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So, what's up?
Job creation accelerated in October, which was a big surprise.
Wow.
Because economists forecast an increase of about 120,000 jobs, and they got 204,000 jobs.
And it would have been higher than that if the Republicans hadn't shut down the government.
Probably would, but nevertheless, they were quite pleased with that. Also, the prior 2 months were revived up by a total of 60,000 jobs. So that was considered good, too. In addition, the unemployment rate did tick up slightly from 7.2 to 7.3%. But that is because the week that they did the survey was the week that the federal employees were furloughed for the whole week. And if you're out for a week, you're considered unemployed.
So some 700,000 federal employees, maybe it was more than that. In fact, 800 sticks in my head, 800,000 were considered unemployed for that, which means that probably the unemployment level would have been down by a tenth of a point or two tenths of a point.
It's possible. So this is why this whole, it was sort of like a Halloween monster month, really, for numbers, you know, because everybody's looking at it with a pinch of salt and really waiting for November,
right.
Frankly, because everybody knows that it was messed up. And President Obama referenced the government shutdown in his remarks at the Port of New Orleans today, where he went to talk about the economy and infrastructure and transportation, where he said that we learned yesterday that over the summer our economy grew at its fastest pace in a year. That's the good news. And he said it's like the gears of our economy. Every time they're just about to take off, suddenly someone taps the brakes and says, not so fast.
That's right.
unfortunately, about the government shutdown.
Yeah, yeah, he's right.
And he laid out again his three priorities, which was to pass the farm bill, comprehensive immigration reform. He said, I don't know what the holdup is for the House to take it up, and also a budget. He talked about that. He also said that he wanted to go in himself and fix glitches that have plagued the website.
Is he studying Fortran or COBOL or whatever the language is du jour?
What he said was, but I don't write code.
Yeah, okay. There you go.
Yeah. 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 He acknowledged
I think I'm dating myself by referencing Fortran and COBOL. Those were from
the
60s.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Anyhow, Drupal, I should be saying. But even that, so that's a decade old. So, anyhow,
I don't know
back
what
to
that
you,
is either.
Yeah.
Secretary of State John Kerry in Geneva today said important gaps need to be bridged in the high-stakes talks with Iran. The six powers are meeting there with Iran, and the talks have been extended for another day to Saturday. Russian Foreign Secretary Sergei Lavrov will join the talks tomorrow. So, you know, Kerry's saying, I want to emphasize there's not an agreement at this point. We hope to try to narrow these differences, a lot of language like that. But there's a lot of people there. You've got British Foreign Secretary William Hague, French and German foreign ministers. So you've got the big guys in the room, trying to hammer it out. And of course,
you've got
Javad Zarif, the Iranian foreign minister, as well. Now the question is, you know, are they going to be able to get some kind of interim deal, and will it stick? And then what are the reactions of our allies? Well, Israel utterly rejects it, to quote Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And he said, and what I'm saying is shared by many in the region, whether or not they express that publicly. He's talking about Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, which is interesting. I mean, you know, given that Saudi Arabia is an Arab state, although arguably Iran is not an Arab state, they're a Persian state,
right.
And Iran is not Sunni, they're Shiite. And so there's this chasm between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And Iran now Iraq has become basically a client state to Iran, and large chunks of Lebanon are clients to Iran, and this has got everybody all nervous, I guess.
Exactly, so. And there's a big report on the BBC that Saudi Arabia has actually basically told the Pakistanis, we're the clients, we're ready to buy nuclear weapons from you, we've got the cash, when we say go, you supply. And the minute Iran gets a nuclear weapon, Saudi Arabia will say go, they will get a nuclear weapon, and they've already warned the U.S. of this.
So we don't have to worry about an Arab-Israeli war, we have to worry about a Shia-Sunni war.
A broader Middle Eastern conflict.
Wow.
Cardinal Timothy Dolan of New York sent a letter to Speaker Boehner last night, urging the House to pass immigration reform, or at least yesterday, by the end of the year, saying that the House has a responsibility to debate and attempt to resolve public policy issues that challenge the nation. And he says it's a matter of great moral urgency that cannot wait any longer for action. He said keeping undocumented workers as a permanent underclass is a stain on the soul of our nation.
It's true.
No word that there is any move to bring up any kind of vote on a pathway to citizenship this year. In fact, it's looking unlikely.
This is so sad.
Meantime, CBS News correspondent Lara Logan today on CBS This Morning retracted and apologized for a 60 Minutes report that was based on a supposed eyewitness to the terrorist attacks on the diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya.
All right, which Daryl Issa has been hysterically bloviating about for weeks, ever since 60 Minutes did it, or days, however long it's been.
Right, and which Senator Lindsey Graham has been touting as he's threatened to hold up all Senate nominations.
Yeah. Amazing. I wonder if, you know, Dan Rather actually got it right about George W. Bush going AWOL from the Texas Air National Guard, but he lost his job, and 60 Minutes 2 got shut down. I wonder if Laura Logan, probably not.
No, I think it's just going to be an apology.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. Victoria, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, that works. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Tom Weiss is in the studio with me. He's the president of Climate Crisis Solutions, the website Ride4Renewables.org. And Tom, you just completed a 485-mile bicycle ride to raise awareness about the Keystone XL pipeline. Is that a good snapshot summary of what's up?
Yeah, and specifically the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline.
Yeah, the northern leg has been there for quite some time.
Yeah, the Keystone 1 project was built in 2010, and that's what TransCanada is getting ready to tap into with the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the northern leg, when we talk about the northern leg, that's a whole separate project. Mm-hmm. What happened, I call it bait and switch.
Yeah.
Back in 2011, November of 2011, President Obama made the big pronouncement he was going to delay a decision on the Keystone XL cross-border permit.
Right.
That's when a lot of environmental leaders celebrated, declared victory. It was not a victory. It was only a delay. But what he did, here's the bait and switch part. A few months later, President Obama flew down to Cushing, Oklahoma, the pipeline crossroads of the world, and he directed his administration to fast-track the construction of the southern leg, which is they're going to tap into the Keystone 1, which is built in 2010, and that
so
gives him access.
The southern leg is the one that goes down to the Koch Brothers refinery in the Gulf Coast.
Down the Gulf Coast, yes.
Yeah.
So, and that gives TransCanada access to the refineries and the ports, which is what they want more than anything.
Right, because they want to get that carbon out of this country and get it off to China and England and the northern parts of South America, Brazil, I guess. And
exactly.
Wherever else they can, after they've refined it.
Exactly.
They want to leave the poison here in the United States.
Sure, and dump the poison along the way because, you know, the first Keystone pipeline that I'm referring to, that Keystone 1, spilled 12 times in its first 12 months of operation.
Wow.
So we know this is coming. And, you know, and we're just being treated as a sacrifice zone. And the northern leg, that has to be stopped too. But that has been what most of the environmental groups have been talking about, that cross-border permit. But while they've been talking about that, the southern leg is now 95% completed. So we've got Texas landowners like Michael Bishop and Julia Trigg Crawford who are still fighting down in Texas.
I think it was Julia was on with Daryl Hannah on this program.
I think you were, yes.
Fighting that. Yeah.
Daryl's been amazing.
She has. She's really been working on this thing. We're talking with Tom Weiss. He's the president of Climate Crisis Solutions, RideForRenewables.org. And Climate Crisis Solutions has a website too, right?
It does. I haven't focused much on it. That's my business arm, and I haven't been doing any business because I've been too busy fighting these pipelines.
Yeah, there you go. So RideForRenewables.org is the website, and check it out. And Tom, in Detroit and in Chicago, there are these huge piles of basically poison. It's like almost coal, but not quite. It still contains an enormous amount of carbon, but it can't be burned in the United States because it violates our Clean Air Act. How did these giant piles, and it's blowing over mostly poor minority neighborhoods, how did these giant piles of poison come to be in Detroit and Chicago and other places in the Midwest? Tell me the story of this.
You're talking about the Petcock issue.
Mm.
I'm not well steeped in that. To be quite honest,
my understanding is this is what's left over when you refine coal tar, this kind of stuff that we're bringing down from Canada, that the residual product that's left over is. Because it's basically bituminous coal, you know.
That's my understanding as well. Yes.
And they're functionally powdering it, mixing it with water and
right.
and basically a little bit of oil and pumping it down the pipeline. And so when they refine it, what's left over isn't just the normal refinery output, but it's this kind of fly ash stuff, and it's pretty amazing.
Well, so, I just want to say that's just. I'm glad you raised it because that's another byproduct of this whole process.
And the Gulf Coast is now going to be swimming in this stuff. Although, I guess, you know, there are countries where it's legal to burn this stuff, you know, like China. And so if they refine it down in the Gulf Coast, then they can get it out of the United States. But
I'm sure they'll be barging it there.
You bet.
Overseas.
But it's like, we shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah, I mean, tar sands should be stopped, period. I mean, we can't be mining tar sands. I mean, we need to be getting off fossil fuels as quickly as possible. We need to transition like yesterday.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So.
Now, there was a piece a week or so ago, we did a show on it here, where just the Koch brothers themselves might make as much as $100 billion from the Keystone Pipeline.
Yes.
I mean, they're not even worth that much. No wonder people would fund, you know, the Heartland Institute or these other right-wing groups that are engaged in aggressive climate change denial.
Sure.
I mean, you spend a few million bucks here and there, or even tens or hundreds of millions of dollars, to make $100 billion?
Right.
It's like, whoa.
And this is one of their last stands. I mean, this is a very, you know, desperate act on the part of the fossil fuel industry, but it's a very profitable one, obviously, for them.
Yeah. Yeah. So what can Americans do?
Well, one thing is Americans can support our brave fellow Americans like Michael Bishop and Julia Trigg Crawford, two Texas landowners who are still duking it out with TransCanada and with the federal government down in Texas. So
how?
They can support their legal defense funds, and you can find them on the web easily enough.
From your website for that?
I'm going to put some up after this show.
Okay.
So
you can go to rideforrenewables.org.
Yeah, starting tomorrow. I will have those on my website for both landowners. But they could support their lawsuits. I mean, that's probably the biggest thing at this juncture in terms of stopping the Southern Lag.
Calling your elected representatives might be a good idea.
Well, that never
hurts.
Raise
political
hell. It's just unfortunate how much oil money is saturating our
pull together a rent a local hall or you know get the local school to give you the gymnasium for the night and then invite your local your elected state senators, state representatives, your U.S. Congress person, whoever it may be, invite them to show up, and if they don't show up, you know, put a cardboard dummy of them and debate them.
I love that idea.
You know,
chair, the cardboard dummy.
Yeah. Yeah, this is actually not my idea. This is Bernie Sanders' idea.
Bernie Sanders.
He's like, somebody called up
what
once
a guy.
From some town in, I think it was Oklahoma or something, some place where they had some Republican right-wing crazy who was the member of House of Representatives. And they said, I can't talk to this guy. I can't lobby him. He doesn't, he ignores my phone call. What do I do? And Bernie said, rent a hall, put out the notices that he's invited, you know, give him a formal invitation. And if he doesn't show up, you know, debate a cardboard figure. I don't know that was Bernie's exact words, but you know something.
The general
to that effect,
idea.
You know, it's
great.
You know, it's like create a town hall. They will show up more often than not. They you'll shame them into it.
Well, here's another thing people can do, Tom, is show up at the White House like we did yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
We had a small but incredibly committed band of climate justice leaders who were at the White House yesterday, and we held up a banner that had a big photo of Michael Bishop's property being destroyed by TransCanada, the Keystone XL pipeline down in Texas.
Yeah.
And the title was President Obama's Tar Sands Pipeline because he approved this. He owns it.
Yeah.
He owns it.
Well,
which means call
the White House comment line.
Yeah, absolutely. And he could stop this. I mean, you know, if his administration can conjure up a way to start this pipeline, they can conjure up a way to stop it.
Yeah. Although, you know, it almost seems like the best thing to do right now is to really, really be pushing for a carbon tax. Because
on the big picture, I think that's one of the most effective
things we can do. If you do that,
then
we're going to reach a point where they're going to start looking at other things to run
sure.
through this pipeline.
Then we're not
maybe water or something.
Pipeline, yes.
Yeah.
I agree, Tom. Carbon tax.
Because there's a larger systemic issue here as well.
Absolutely.
Tom Weiss, the website is rideforrenewables.org. Check it out. Tom, great work you're doing. Thanks for dropping by.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And,
always great to be on your show.
And it must be really, your heart must be in great shape.
I feel
485
good.
Miles.
That's I feel good.
Everybody should get out there and do something for the environment. We'll be right back. And check out our video at lasthours.org, too.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Once again, Tom's website, rideforrenewables.org. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see here. Norma in Montgomery, Alabama, watching us on Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. Hey, Norma, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm also kind of watching the C-SPAN 2 EPA hearing at the same time.
So you're multitasking.
And they're talking about coal industry and the EPA. This is
really?
Trying to increase coal production in West Virginia and Pennsylvania versus natural gas. All of this stuff that they want to continue to mine in West Virginia, you keep having these slag piles. And they also, you know, take the tops off of mountains. They're supposed to put stuff back the way it was. But they log everything off, and then they do their strip mining in the mountains. This creates a pollution problem that, of course, blows right towards you. And none of this stuff is actually environmentally sound. Instead of going for wind turbines and solar panels, we keep going after more coal and we keep going after more fracking to get natural gas. And all of this stuff, they can say it creates jobs. But it doesn't really create jobs. It creates an environmental problem that all of us are going to have to live with. And
well, you could say Hurricane Sandy created a lot of jobs. A lot of houses need to be rebuilt. A lot of people's lives need to be put back together. I mean, you know, the question is, do we want to be creating those kind of jobs?
Well, I know, and you know, they're also talking about increasing the number of nuclear reactors. And here in Alabama, we have two different locations where we have nuclear reactors. In the past 10 years, we've had 241 incidents at those nuclear reactors.
Whoa.
And they, you know, like the mining out in Colorado. That what if we get? We don't need more uranium to create more nuclear reactors. We need greener energy.
Mm-hmm.
And to keep going after coal and creating all these slag piles and destroying the environment, and this stuff blows in the air, and you have increased health risk, and it's just not worth the long-term health risk to keep doing this coal mining.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody even realizes that this debate is on there today with the way the EPA will be able to regulate this stuff.
So tell me what is happening. Is this the House or the Senate, and is it a hearing, or is this an EPA hearing that has nothing to do with Congress?
This is an EPA regulation in the coal industry hearing, and they're having different people, you know, of course, pro and against, but, you know, they keep talking about jobs and the economy, but nobody's really talking about the environment. It's just like, let's get rid of the EPA and do what we want to do to produce energy. But it doesn't do anything about creating green energy here in the country. And it's like that pipeline they want to run across Texas. Has anybody ever heard of the New Madrid Fault Line? Is this the terrain where we want a pipeline?
Right. Well, and not just that. I mean, you've got
crazy.
There's a minor industry in America fetishizing 9/11. You know, all these neocons who want to go bomb Iran and every place else and, you know, take out every Muslim on earth and, you know, put TSA on hyper vigilance and everything else because they're all frightened about terrorism. And we're going to build a 2,000 mile long, put a bullseye on it. You know, if somebody really wanted to harm this country, you can't defend a pipeline like that.
Well, not only that, why would you put it on top of an unmapped fault line?
Yeah, very good question. Norma, you do it because the Koch brothers can make millions, billions of dollars. That's why you do it. Norma, thanks for watching Free Speech TV, and thanks for the call. Spot on. Excellent comment. We'll be right back. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour, and Anything Goes Friday. John in Jeffersonville, Ohio. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, how are you doing, Tom?
Good. What's on your mind?
Good. Yeah, Tom, I have something my dad taught me a long time ago, is that bad things happen when good people don't stand up.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to relay a kind of a story. I drive a truck, and the right wing is all it's on the radio. And most of my people I work with, they are so right-wing, it's unreal. And there's a certain amount of racism that goes in that right-wing, and I don't know where that comes from, but it seems to be true.
Mm-hmm.
So I was sitting in the driver's room. There's probably 10, 12 of us waiting for paperwork. And one of the guys comes in, and he starts telling a joke, and we're listening, and it starts going racist. Now, I called him out. I stood up, and I said, man, that is so inappropriate. I said, it's racist. It's not called for. This is a work environment, and it really shouldn't be done, you know.
Mm.
Well, you could have heard a pin drop. It got real quiet.
Mm.
And a guy behind me, the big guy, probably 6'2", he looked at the guy, and he said, you know, he said, I adopted a daughter, and in fact, you know, she was like 2 years old when I adopted her. And she's a black girl, and I don't appreciate it. And, oh, my God, it was.
Wow.
And since then, there has been, when I'm in the room or when he's in the room, and I don't think that it goes on. I think the word got out that you know, it was just getting programmed. He put him on the spot. It was like a you know, like ants with a magnifying glass.
Mm-hmm.
He was burned.
Yeah.
And he just, it really brought it down. And this actually goes to a larger point. And that is this: the Democratic Party is guilty, and I really applaud you because I've disagreed with you on several issues. You've been real light on them, but it seems like you're bringing the heat down a little bit more on them, and I like that. That they need to stand up. If the Progressive Caucus is the largest caucus in Congress, yet they're the most. They're the least powerful. They're not standing up, and they're not delivering.
They actually do a lot of stuff. It's just none of it ever gets covered by the media because you've got a corporate media that wants to cover Republicans. And so anytime a Republican, you know, farts, it becomes national news. Progressive Caucus holds a press conference. I mean, you had several members of the Progressive Caucus 2 weeks ago got arrested, chained to the gate of the White House, and it didn't make the news. I mean, if Ted Cruz had just looked dirty at a cop at the in front of the White House, it would have been, you know, three days of the news cycle. So,
honestly, answer me though.
Yeah.
Between a Republican and a Democrat, generic, okay, just a generic one. Which one fights stronger and more fervently for their position? Honestly.
Depends on how you define fights. You know, Alan Grayson is out there, you know.
I agree. I love the guy.
Speaking out. And Peter DeFazio is speaking out. And these people are just, you know, they're calling them out. Sherrod Brown calling them out. Bernie Sanders calling them out. Jan Schakowsky calling them out. There are some good people in Congress who are fighting a good fight. You know, Mark Pocan calling them out constantly. The problem is the media doesn't cover it very much. And their colleagues, by and large, feel free to ignore them because they're desperately worried about where they're going to get the $150,000 or the $1.5 million that they need to run the next election. And
agreed.
That is the cancer at the core of our political system is that this economic cancer that the Supreme Court has inserted there.
But would you agree that we need to hold the Democrats' feet to the fire a little bit more so that we can motivate them, maybe?
John, I think that there is a very fine line between pushing people and turning into the circular firing squad. And one of the things that concerns me is that some of my colleagues have become the circular firing squad. I don't think you shoot at people in order to motivate them. I think that you hold them up when they do well. You call them out when they do bad. But you don't do it in a way that just, you know, trashes them forever and, oh, yeah, it's just another corporate, you know, that kind of, I don't find any value in that. If we want to see political change in the United States, we need to be doing two major things. And these are the two things that the billionaires were funding back in 2008, 2009, 2010, getting ready in particular for the election of 2010 and the census of 2010 when they could do redistricting and gerrymandering. And the two things they did, if you look at Concord Project, go on to YouTube.com and type in Concord Project or precinct committee person. And you will see the videos that were given to thousands of Tea Partiers all around this country about how to show up at your local Republican Party and say, I want to volunteer and be a precinct committee person. Because those precinct committee people are the only people. And in most cases, both Republican and Democratic, you can show up and volunteer and they will say, great, the door is wide open. It's not like trying to take over NBC News. They're just sitting there for the pickings, right? And those committee precinct people are the ones who do two things. They write the party platform and they pick who's going to run in the primaries. And those Concord Project videos, they come right out and say the precinct committee people are more powerful than the president of the United States. They're the ones who pick the primary candidates. So in a district, you can have five primary candidates, make sure they're all Tea Partiers, and it doesn't matter who wins. You're going to send a Tea Partier to Congress if it's a reliably Republican district. Progressives need to be doing that. So that's the first thing we need to do is stop complaining and start inserting ourselves into the political process. In some cases, these are even paid gigs. Usually, though, it's volunteer. But it's usually not more than a couple, one or two nights a month. And number two is join one of the groups that's actually doing grassroots activism, progressive activism. My two favorites, and there's a bunch of good ones. You know, Howard Dean or his brother, I'm forgetting his first name, runs one called Democracy for America. There's a whole bunch of them, but my two favorites are MoveToAmend.org and PDAmerica.org, Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, and MoveToAmend.org. Join these groups and start a local chapter in your living room and invite your neighbors over and, outside of the political party structure. So you do something outside of the political party structure like the Tea Party did, and then you you also infiltrate the party structure. The Tea Partiers did this. The right-wingers did this to the Republican Party. We need to do it to the Democratic Party. Thank you, John.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
That's why I just don't think that forming the circular firing squad and saying, okay, we're gonna spend an hour here complaining about something. I don't think that works. 28 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Apropos of what I was saying before, I just went over to YouTube and just pulled one of these things up. And I'll just play a little bit. This is from the Concord Project. And just so you can hear it, I mean, this was a how-to for Tea Partiers. And it was put up 3 years ago, September of 2010, getting ready for the elections of 2010. And... a lot of this stuff was done on videotapes or on discs, rather, DVRs and things, and passed out to people, person to person. It wasn't just, done on YouTube so much. But this is one that made its way to YouTube. Just listen.
What's the most powerful political office in the world? It is not the President of the United States. It's precinct committeemen. Why? There's three main reasons. First, because precinct committeemen and only precinct committeemen get to elect the leaders of the political parties. If you want to elect the leadership of one of the two major political parties in this country, then you have to become a precinct committeeman.
One of the two.
Second, precinct committeemen and only precinct committeemen can vote in internal party elections to endorse candidates in the all-important, traditionally very low turnout primary elections. If a candidate wants to win the general election, he first has to get onto the general election ballot. To get on the general election ballot, he has to win the primary election. And the best way to win the primary election is to get the endorsement of as many party committees as possible. Precinct committeemen are organized into committees. For example, every county has a party committee. Every state legislative district.
He goes on. He's just explaining this. The most powerful people in America. And you can be one of them. So, instead of calling up and complaining about, I don't think this guy's good. Hey, jump in there. Andrew in Ashland, Pennsylvania. Are you seriously calling to ask why I'm so anti-Republican?
I'm sorry. Can you repeat that? Seriously calling for what?
Are you seriously calling to ask why I am so anti-Republican?
Oh, actually, my question was originally that free speech TV in general is like anti-corruption, whether it's Republicans or Democrats.
Generally. I can't actually speak for free speech TV. I'm not an employee.
Yeah, okay, well, I watch you on free speech TV. But actually, my question is about the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Okay.
And I understand that even Congress now don't have access to it. Now,
that's
are
right.
there laws that say Congress should be the party negotiating a treaty?
No, actually, what the Constitution says is that the executive branch negotiates treaties. The president negotiates treaties, which is what's happening with the TPP. The treaties then go to the Senate. The House is not even involved. The treaties then go to the Senate where they require a two-thirds vote. This process has been perverted since the days of the Nixon administration through a process called Fast Track, which was first put into law in 1973 or 74 or 72. It was in the early 70s during the Nixon administration. And they have stopped referring to these trade agreements as treaties and started referring to them as trade agreements and therefore saying that they no longer meet the constitutional muster of a treaty. So it doesn't require two-thirds of the Senate and the appropriate debate there, you know, associated therewith. But instead, it's simple legislation that can be dropped on the floor of both the House and the Senate and just requires 51% vote. And I think it's wrong. I think it's unconstitutional. And I'm horrified by it. Making sense,
and
Andrew?
The Senate, it has enough Democrats so that it doesn't go through. And plus, all what they are doing is changing the name from treaty to agreement.
That's correct.
It's like treaty.
That's correct. I still think these things are treaties. And exactly. I don't know if the Supreme Court has weighed in on this or not. This would be a good question to put to somebody,
yeah.
you know, who's a real expert on that area. In fact, we should probably get.
So in all honesty, my point was that there are corrupt Democrats, and we
of course there are.
To expose that, and we're going to lose all the jobs because of this treaty.
There are many corrupt Democrats, and I would be the first to tell you that. My point was not to say we should all be going all hail the Democratic Party. My point was that 9 out of 10 of the times when somebody calls me up and starts going off on the Democratic Party or Democrats in general or Hillary Clinton isn't progressive enough or whatever, fill in the blanks. If I ask them, have you ever shown up at a party meeting? Have you ever volunteered time? Have you ever even joined any of the organizations that push the party? Organizations like Move to Amend or Progressive Democrats. They say, no, I just want to sit on my butt and whine. And I don't think that's particularly useful.
No, my political thinking is really leaning left more than right. Like by far, I'm reading more on the left, and I agree with 90% of all the things you say on your program. But this time, there is something that's happening that's going to make the country lose a lot of jobs.
I agree, and it's been going on. I mean, in a big way, in a very public way, since the election of 1992, when Ross Perot pulled almost 20% of the vote for president on one single issue, which was his opposition to NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO, and he was right, and both Bill Clinton and President George Herbert Walker Bush were wrong, and that 20%, I think, has grown to 40-50%, and I think if the Democratic Party, and they already are. Largely, I mean, most of the opposition to these so-called free trade deals exists within the Democratic Party. If the Democratic Party would officially take that position, they would never lose another election. And they would officially take that position. And if enough people like you and me, Andrew, were to show up at Democratic Party meetings and say, you know, I want to be a precinct committee person because we get to write the platform. Janet in Gustine, California. Hey, Janet, what's up?
Yes, Tom. I wanted to tell you something about that I heard about TPP that was kind of scary. But first of all, I'd like, if when you have Richard Wolff on, would you please ask him to expound on the Mercora law that Italy has?
Okay.
I think it might be a pretty good idea for us. TPP, I wish I knew the gentleman's name. Because I think it would be wise for you to have him on, he has said that there is very little about trade in the Trans-Pacific.
Right. There's a lot about copyright law. There's a lot about intellectual protection, property protection. There's a lot of banking.
It's about
labor law.
The corporations gaining world power.
Yes. Yes. Well, that has been the case with every single one of these treaties. Right now, you've got a situation we had in the United States back in the 60s and 70s. The Humane Society of America, as I recall, and I'm pretty sure it was the Humane Society. It might have been another animal rights group, but I think it was the Humane Society, took this position that that killing dolphins in order to fish for tuna was a bad thing. And the reason why the two things are associated is when tuna feed, they're giant fish, and they just hit schools of smaller fish and just mow through them, and they leave behind a lot of debris, a lot of pieces of dead fish. And so when tuna are going through, and tuna do this at about 200 feet below the surface, right? So the tuna are flying along 100 feet below the surface, and they're leaving all these entrails and fish guts and stuff. Well, the dolphins love eating that stuff, and the dolphins are air breathers. They're mammals, and so they're on the surface. And so the dolphins on the surface are almost always, or very often, are following schools of tuna underneath, just behind the tuna, or sometimes right above them, and they're eating the stuff that the tuna leave over, you know, the leftovers, right? And so when they started doing this, what's called purslane netting, these giant mile-long nets to catch tuna, these nets, they didn't just, you know, they didn't drop down 200 feet below the water and just get the tuna. They brought them right up to the water level, and they got the tuna and the dolphins. And the dolphins died, and they would kill the dolphins and throw them overboard. Or there are actually a few places in the world where they sell dolphin meat. And so the Humane Society said, let's put a stop to this. It was a 25-year campaign in the United States to have dolphin-free tuna, dolphin-safe tuna. We finally passed it into law in the United States that it was, you know, that if you were fishing for tuna, you had to do it in a way that didn't kill dolphin. It's a little more expensive, but it's possible to do. That was the law in the United States starting in the early 1990s or the late 1980s. They finally got this thing passed after 20 years. And then we signed NAFTA. Bill Clinton signed NAFTA, I think, in 96. And when we signed NAFTA, it gave a tribunal, which was made up not of government officials, but of corporations. It gave a tribunal the ability to determine whether our laws were in harmony with Mexico's laws. And the Mexican fishing fleet said, you know, we want to put an end to this dolphin-safe tuna fishing in North America, in the United States. And they sued us, and we lost. And so now it's no longer against the law to fish that way. You can find tuna that does say dolphin safe on it. You know, there are companies that fish that way, and they charge a little more for it, but it's not the law in the United States anymore. And so the dolphins are being killed again. And this is crazy. I mean, the will of the people was overturned by an industry that wasn't even an American industry. It was from another country. And this, you know, we went through this back 25 years ago. So, and TPP is going to put this thing on steroids. Jana, thank you for the call. This is just the beginning. There's a whole chapter about this in my book on equal protection, about these, you know, international trade deals, GATT, NAFTA, WTO. I tell the story, in fact, of tuna in there. That's how I knew it. So I researched it when I was writing on equal protection. Anyhow, we'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
How do you define capitalism? Why do we have economies? These are really important questions.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Lincoln, listening on WBAI in Mount Vernon, New York. Hey, Lincoln, what's on your mind?
Hey, how are you?
I'm great, but I'll get better. I hope the same is true of you.
Yeah. In reference to the insurance companies charging more for people who decide to switch, I think we are a little bit disingenuous. And I must preface what I'm going to say with this. I'm neither Republican nor Democrat. I'm not for any particular politician, especially if they're not functioning as servants of the people. Now, The Obamacare was written by the insurance company. And I think because of the racist I say so-called Republicans, because I think all these names, Republicans and Democrats, get us lost and make us stop looking at justice and truth and all these things. You know? And because of those racists, it's difficult to criticize Obama genuinely, because then you're going to become categorized like those people. And we have to say that Obama squandered his political currency when he first came in. When Obama came in, he had the world behind him. He could have went for single payer. And Obama went for the Obamacare because the insurance companies supported his reelection. Every move Obama made was for his reelection. It was not a move for the people. And as a matter of fact, you know, there is a...
Lincoln, you're making good points. You're making good points, but it's not quite that simple, because the president doesn't write legislation. And so you had the Democrats in Congress who were looking out for their reelection, too. And yes, the health insurance companies were spreading a lot of money around there, too, and lobbying a lot there, too. And, you know, President Obama, when he was running for the state Senate in Illinois, said he was in favor of single payer. So he's obviously familiar with it. But then by the time he got to the United States Senate, it was, well, let's have a public option. In fact, you'll recall he campaigned against Hillary Clinton against Obamacare. Hillary Clinton was the more the proposal that Obamacare was more the proposal that Hillary Clinton was bringing forward, which was actually originally written by the Heritage Foundation. And then Mitt Romney put it into place in Massachusetts. But, you know, I get your point. What's your solution?
You know, let me say this, because what I want to say is really quite a bit, but there's not enough time.
Right, we have 1 minute.
Actually, we must start looking for people who we must design a political system that forces politicians to be servants of the people rather than oppressors of the people. The way it is designed right now,
I agree.
As soon as they get into power.
I agree. If I may respectfully, Lincoln, the major flaw in our political system right now is that our Supreme Court, who have elevated themselves to the level of kings and queens, has designated property, money, as being the same thing as speech, and then said that that speech is therefore protected under the First Amendment, which is insane. There is a group called MoveToAmend.org that is pushing a constitutional amendment to do away with that Supreme Court-created doctrine. You get that doctrine out of the way, and then we can have genuine political reform in the United States. We can get money out of politics, and then we can have single-payer health care. I think that's the original sin, the core cancer. I strongly encourage you to check out MoveToAmend.org. The head guy there is David Cobb. He ran for president on the Green Party ticket. Thank you, Lincoln. Thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Albert Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the various companies and organizations that syndicate this program, Westwood One on commercial radio stations, Pacifica Radio on non-commercial stations, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV, which carries us also on Dish Network and DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, and the others around the country, to the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, all the great folks at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you in particular for supporting our program. We wouldn't be here without you. Thank you so much. Okay, Philip in Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Philip, you wanted to define capitalism?
Yeah, I think that would be a good starting point for a lot of discussions. When do you believe capitalism began?
I think capitalism began when they started locking up the food. I think it began with the agricultural revolution.
Simon Kuznets, economic historian, states that the Industrial Revolution was all about a transformation of fixed capital. The concept of fixed capital is really dependent on the material.
Well, okay, you could argue that feudalism, are you suggesting that feudalism was a non-capitalist system because of hereditary wealth and all that kind of thing?
Yes.
Okay, all right, so you're slicing much more finely than I am.
Now, let's just look at it technologically.
Sure.
If most of your machinery is made out of wood, it is not fixed capital. You have to spend most of your profits fixing it all the time.
Right.
Until you have machinery that's made overwhelmingly out of iron or steel, you cannot have capitalism in the sense that you take the profits from your production and reinvest them to make more profits.
But there have been people who have been making money with money.
On technology.
There have been people who have been making money with money, I would argue, ever literally for 10,000 years, ever since the beginning of the agricultural revolution. There's no way to do that in a hunting-gathering society, which is why hunting-gathering societies are typically referred to as obligation societies or potlatch societies, where you gain status by giving away. On the other hand, once we started growing food, particularly in temperate climates, where there was a time during the year when no food could grow, whoever controlled the food that had been locked up, and Daniel Quinn does a brilliant exposition of this with his book Ishmael, once somebody locked up the food and said, I'm the guy in charge of the food, that food functionally became capital because it's essential for everybody else. And that guy was able to say, okay, you want some of this food? Do that. Do this for me. Do that for me. And thus began everything that I would say leads us to capitalism. In fact, I would argue that in the book of Genesis, one of the two creation stories in the book of Genesis is an explicit warning from an ancient hunting-gathering society about don't become an agricultural society, that's the story of Cain and Abel. You'll recall that Cain, the killer brother, was the agriculturalist. He was the one who grew the crops, and he was the one that God did not favor his offering, which is why he got so upset that he killed his brother, who was the herder. And, you know, I think this is a warning against capitalism and against...
Of history. There's two different types of history.
Sure.
Okay, what are they?
I don't know.
There's narrative history. That's the way most English historians write.
Right.
There's a materialist historians like the French do, Fernand Braudel in particular, three volumes of Civilization and Capitalism. The material conditions do not dictate how your society is formed, but they have explanatory power. They can explain, if you look at the material conditions, no matter what this pope or that general or this president does, the material conditions are going to push you into a certain type of society. We like to think that individuals, if we had a good president, he could solve all our problems.
Right.
No, the material conditions within which he operates don't dictate what he has to do.
But the industrial, let's go back to the industrial revolution. The industrial revolution hit us full tilt boogie around the time of the Civil War, but it was still going on really strongly in the 1930s. What was different between Harding Coolidge Hoover's policies and Franklin Roosevelt's policies with regard to capital?
That's material conditions. I want to keep this on material conditions.
But material conditions changed during that period of time.
Do you know how you made iron before the coke was figured out how to make iron out of coke?
No.
The blast furnaces depended on charcoal.
Right.
It took you forever to get a big enough pile of charcoal to make iron.
Okay.
If you made the pile too big, it collapsed. Typical blast iron furnaces operated for maybe 15 weeks out of a year, sometimes only one or...
So coal must have revolutionized that.
Coke revolutionized that. It did not really predominate in industrial production up until about late 1700s.
Yeah, this is the late 18th century, early 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The first metallurgical success with coke was 1780.
Okay, well, here's the question. Philip, let me just, because we're almost out of time, let me just bring this down to the ground. Actually, I can't. I'm out of time. I'm sorry. We're going to have this conversation another time, Philip, because I'm finding it fascinating. I'm just curious. If you're asserting that capitalism is a consequence of the Industrial Revolution and the evils of capitalism, therefore, are, what's the solution? But I'm sorry, we just don't have time for the discussion. It's the kind of stuff that I find fascinating. Coming up next, we'll have all the latest news and information you won't hear in the corporate media, plus your calls. And don't forget, my new book, The Crash of 2016, just came out, hitting the road for book tour next week. And B, democracy is not a spectator sport. You have to participate. Get out there. Show up. Get active. You know, complaining is okay, but do something about it. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.